And now, Forward with Falk. Join Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen as they navigate their way through the political thicket. Well, Dave, a guy who is locally important but really statewide important died this week. And more than statewide important, because the issue that one of his most famous cases revolved around is now a national issue. And he's somebody you knew, and that was Judge James Munley. I wonder if you could talk about him and his significance.
Yeah. I've been friends and close with the Munley family for a long, long time. I worked with his brother, Robert Munley, who died only a few months ago, for over 40 years. And actually, when I started as a lawyer, Judge Munley was part of the firm, and he was running for judge. They came from a very political family. His grandfather was a state representative. His father was a state representative. And unfortunately, his father died as a young man, died at age 40 while in office. And his mother wound up taking over the seat for most of the time. She was the only or one of only a couple of women in the state legislature. And she raised two boys by herself, and both of them became successful lawyers. And Judge Munley ran when I was just starting out for county court, and eventually he became a federal judge. But he really knew what the word justice meant. He understood that that the law had to work for the people. He came from very humble background. He was his obituary indicated, he was a son of the town of Archibald, which isn't a very big town. He knew everybody there. His mother used to say her home office was her kitchen table, and everybody in town used to who needed something or wanted advice would come to her, and he saw this growing up. And so he had an innate feeling for people, and he was a very, very outgoing person. You couldn't help but like, as he called himself, Jim Munley. He was a pretty successful in terms of a politician, but as a judge, he was extremely competent. He was extremely fair. He understood what the powers of a judge were. And he had a couple of really big cases as a federal judge. The biggest one was the Hazleton case, where, as you remember, Lou Barletta, who decided that his career was going to be on waging war against immigrants, particularly Hispanics, forgetting his own immigrant background, had gotten passed in Hazleton some pretty draconian measures about people who may or may not have been undocumented living in Hazleton and requiring landlords to report things and what have you. And a case was brought in federal court, and Judge Munley was assigned to it. And he wrote a very, very long and detailed opinion that eventually found its way to the Supreme Court. It was a companion case to one in Arizona. And Judge Munley said that Hazleton didn't really have the power. It was the federal government that had to regulate immigration and things like that. And the Supreme Court upheld him. So that was a big consequence. And then, of course, what happened was because Hazleton lost the case, he had to impose legal fees on the town, the city of Hazleton, for the people that defended against that. And, of course, that had ramifications to the city itself. Lou Barletta cost Hazleton a lot of money. It also cost them a lot of emotion and political division. So he was a significant figure in local and, as you said, national legal areas. And he'll be missed. He was a good friend and a great guy. And I worked with his daughter Julia, who's now a Lackawanna County judge, and his wife Kathleen, who is a professor of history at Marywood University, and very distinguished in her own right.
Of course, if Munley had acted differently, or if his decision had not been upheld by the Supreme Court, then you would have had states' rights being used in the ways the argument for states' rights had developed. That is to say, it was developed in order to protect slavery and to prevent the federal government from ending slavery. And now it could have been used to protect anti-immigrant racism and to, make sure that every reactionary town and village, maybe every reactionary state, every state captured by people like Art Pope did in North Carolina, could have their own immigration policy and their own discriminatory policy against immigrants. Munley couldn't have foreseen that the racists would have captured control of the federal government, but he did the best he could.
Right. And it goes back to the debate that we had at the founding of the Republic, the role of government, the role of the states versus the federal government, that was radically changed, of course, by the Civil War and the subsequent amendments to the Constitution. And it's kind of ironic, as you said, right now we're back into this debate stage about the role of government, what government can and cannot do, I think today the courts might be ruling differently on certain issues, which again allow for, as you said, discrimination against certain groups. Instead of having big tent, they're dividing everybody into little tents and putting some of those tents on, I guess, what you would call the other side of the tracks. We've seen that, over the last couple of weeks with the response to the virus and what the government under Donald Trump has been saying. You know, he's refused to act under his powers of the federal government, the Defense Production Act. He's been saying that this is a matter for the states and the governors to do certain things, or the private sector. And we're having this private versus public sector argument that the Koch brothers have been fostering for the last 40 plus years. And it's coming down in very interesting ways back and forth this week, including with the deal that was struck by Congress.
Well, Trump said that he wouldn't use the powers of the Defense Production Act because that would be socialist. And he compared the Defense Production Act to Venezuela and the form of government that they have in Venezuela. And he said it doesn't work. And then, of course, 4 days later, he had to enforce the Defense Production Act against General Motors because it does work. In fact, it was the only thing that worked, because although he said General Motors was going to produce all of these ventilators, it turned out they had no intention of producing any ventilators.
Yeah, he's trying to have it both ways on everything. If you look and you listen to what he says, he's very clever about this. He says, for instance, with the malaria drug that he has a hard time reading the name of, he says it might work, might not.
Right. He always ends up with, who knows? We'll see.
Who knows? Who knows? We'll see. That's exactly right. And, of course, with the Defense Production Act, he says, well, I signed the bill. So he's taking credit for signing it. But, of course, weeks went by when he didn't act on the bill.
Well, he's only acted on it once in regard to the General Motors and the ventilators. That's the only thing.
Now, we talked last week. We did point out that during World War II, it did work. The federal government went in. They went in with an independent commission, and they said, auto companies, Ford, you're going to build airplanes, and Willis, you're going to build Jeeps and whatever it is, and we're going to pay you, but we're going to pay you what we, we're not, your cost plus type of thing. So it can and it has worked. And of course, there are people that don't want to have this thing work. They'd rather see that it not work. And, and what we saw this week also was...
Well, it's the only thing that worked. It's the only thing that worked.
Yeah.
Before they had it, they couldn't get it. They couldn't get anything done.
Well, and also the states were competing against each other.
They still are today. They ought to still.
Yeah, for the resources that the federal government could be forcing production on and allocating and distributing on a more equitable basis. But, there's I think a layer of politics. We had Trump come out this week and trash governors, Democratic governors, by the way, particularly the governor, and as he put it, the woman governor of Michigan.
Well, that's certainly two strikes against her right there.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, that might have been a huge political blunder because, first of all, he won Michigan by a very slim margin. And number two, Governor Whitmer is a very, very popular governor. She shows she's doing things. Remember, she was the governor. She was the person that the Democrats designated this year to respond to the State of the Union. So, you know, which kind of brings us into the politics of it, because we have Joe Biden, who's now the presumptive nominee of the party, who said that he's going to have a woman as his running mate. And of course, people are speculating, would it be Stacey Abrams or Kamala Harris, black women? Or I've been noting that Amy Klobuchar, I thought, was running for vice president all along. And her big pitch is she could win the industrial or formerly industrial states, you know, around the Great Lakes. And lo and behold, now we have this lady, governor, Gretchen Whitmer, who Trump has sort of made a martyr in the cause, and who isn't shy about taking him on in terms of this. And it'll be interesting to watch the political dynamics of it. But, you know, we don't want to talk about the political right now. We've got to talk about lives and this argument that keeps coming up about the economy versus lives.
Yeah, but that is the political. In fact, I think that Trump, unlike the Democrats, understands that this is the election. This is the campaign. He's on the television every night, 6 o'clock, 5 to 7, 5 to 8, however long he wants to be there. The information he gives is either false or tends to be false, or if there's no information at all, it's just preening and saying, I did this, I did that, I did the other. Since yesterday, I saved more lives. Now we're doing more testing, and there's no testing. And, you know, it's just all made up, or it's an attempt to deny what he did the week before. I didn't do it. He does it all the time. And his ratings, they're not going up, but they're not going down. And yet they should be going down because he botched everything. Well, and he's continuing to botch
Well, there's a couple of things to unpack in what you're saying. You're absolutely right. First of all, he's been deprived of his ability to go around the country and have these massive rallies. That was his meat and potatoes, so to speak, that he could gin up the base with these things. And people would come from far and wide to do this and, you know, to be part of that crowd, to be that self-reinforcing crowd. And he can't have that right now. So this is the substitute for that.
Why don't the Democrats realize that and do it toe-to-toe? Why didn't they negotiate in public instead of in secret? Why didn't they get on the radio or however they should do it every day, Nancy Pelosi, Schumer, whoever, Biden, and say, this is what we stood for today. This is what we proposed today. This is the main things we're trying to get at today. McConnell won't do it. The Republicans won't do it.
Well, some of that has been out there, but it you know, when you're trying to out-megaphone the president of the United States, who's a master of the megaphone, it's very, very difficult. They did talk
Biden's
about...
whole shtick is that he's been the vice president. He's supposed to know how to do this.
Yeah, well, he's done a few things. I think he should be doing something every day, or at least every other day. He had a town hall on Friday night with the Wolf Blitzer. He's had a couple of things from his... You know, it's just not the same, of course, because he can't get up on the podium that says the White House or has the presidential seal. He's in his library or study at his own house. I'm not sure that they have the proper background for that. But Nancy Pelosi certainly could do something. Yeah. She can command those flags behind her in the office of the.
And she could have him standing next to her and say, now I want to introduce Joe Biden or whoever she'd like to introduce.
The travel at least 6 feet away, unlike Trump, who has everybody huddled around him. Right. But, you know, she could cut to Joe Biden on this,
exactly.
this thing. And but they were saying that what they were fighting for. And because the Republican bill, which was You know, McConnell says it's bipartisan. It wasn't bipartisan. They negotiated everything with the Republicans and then went to the Democrats and say, what do you want on this thing? But the Democrats didn't
They didn't negotiate at all. They wrote a bill and they said, here's our bill. And Schumer, who had no power, couldn't do anything about it. And Pelosi said, I'll be in Washington tomorrow. We'll discuss it. And Trump blew up. And McConnell blew up. McConnell said, it's unparalleled. It's unheard of. It's an insult that she should be butting in. But she butt in. She had the right to do it. She had the power to do it.
But we had a lot of the provisions that worked their way into this final bill came from Elizabeth Warren and some of those things.
No, most of them came from Bernie.
Bernie and Elizabeth Warren. I think that from what I understand, Schumer was relying more on Warren's, wording of it. Bernie had, was pushing the ideology and the ideas. Warren, I think, was doing the grunt work on this thing behind the scenes. And she's kind of stepped away, of course, on this. But she doesn't I think she doesn't care whether she's out front or not, as long as what she wants gets into this bill.
I think her main contribution was the notion of accountability, that she didn't want to give Mnuchin and therefore Trump $500 billion dollars to spend as they see fit without accounting for it and without it even being public for 6 months, which is how the Republicans wrote it.
And Democrats got that. One other thing that they got was no stock buybacks. I believe they got that as well, and certain other limitations on some of these companies. But of course, late in the week, what we found out is after he signed it, that Trump had some sort of a signing statement which says that on the accountability, he doesn't feel he has to abide by the fact that it has to be reported right away. Remember, he wanted to have whatever monies was handed out, unreportable for 6 months,
election. Secret for 6 months, right.
Right. So that was going to go to the Kushner and everything. And there were provisions, from what I understand, in the bill, haven't read it, that prohibit the president, the vice president, cabinet members, and certain other people from receiving funds from this thing. But who knows?
The Trump company is not the Trump administration. And there are provisions in the bill. There is a big provision in the bill for, I don't want to get into the details, but it's very beneficial to real estate developers and amounts to something like over a 10-year period, $17 billion in tax rebates.
Well, that was that was a tax relief part of the bill.
Yeah.
And as you know, you've had expertise in this or knowledge in this, that what it previously was, there was very favorable things for developers in terms of carrying forward losses. That's why Trump doesn't want his taxes released, because he's carried forward losses. He's the master of losses, by the way, whether on paper or real, to avoid paying taxes. What this did, from what I saw, said you can now set off your losses not against your real estate losses, but also against any money you make in the stock market.
All income. That's right.
All income. So that was
It is carry back, so you can redo your past taxes.
Yeah. Now I understand there was a limit about that they could do it for up to 3 years, but whatever. That's getting too much in the details. But those kind of things were in the bill, and we're going to find out other things that may or may not have been slipped in as this goes in.
And all of this is what they claim is what's necessary to make the economy healthy. But obviously, makes the economy healthy only if your concept of the economy is profits.
And it's going to deprive the federal government more of tax revenues down the road.
Exactly.
But the main thing is on this was this is like a tourniquet. They had to stop the bleeding on this, and they're trying to get some money into the economy, trying to get relief to smaller businesses, trying to get relief to people. You know, there's a whole chain reaction here. You have people who aren't working and people who can't pay their rent. And if they're not working, they can't go out and buy things. And small businesses are closed down and they can't pay their rent. So the people who own the buildings can't pay their rent and they can't pay their taxes. And it goes on and on and on. And then it works its way.
Can't pay their mortgage.
Can't pay their mortgage. Now, I think there may be stuff in the bill about mortgages or what they're trying to do. And then they have to there's probably things in there with the banks, to allow the banks to recoup or to do things while they're not collecting money on mortgages. But I'm not expertise on that, but I'm pretty sure that that's what it is. You know, you still have to have a banking system in the United States. You just hope that what they do is what they did is not have the great giveaway without any recourses. The type of thing they missed 10 years ago when they were or 12 years ago when they were bailing the banks out. You know, stock buybacks were one of these things I think that they prohibited. They were trying to cap what CEOs could make, things like that. And
the point is, if you don't give people cash in hand every week to be able to buy groceries, pay their rent, and whatever, all the benefits that you're going to give to big business and small business goes down the drain. Because if people are without work, you have a depression.
Right.
No matter how much money you give these guys, and no matter what restrictions you put on how they're going to spend it, if you don't give money to people to live, you're going to have a depression, and people will be suffering. And a $1,200 check one time, if this thing lasts 2 months, that is not going to work. That's not going to cut the mustard.
You know, there's two things. I don't want to specifically get the details, but number one, only the federal government can do these things.
Yep.
The states can't. Only the federal government can print money, and only the federal government has work with the Fed on these things. Number two, this leads into the argument about whether the economy is more important than lives, at least in the short run. People are saying we got to put our money into saving the economy. And, again, with this libertarian thing that they use the term the cure is worse than the disease, which
well,
is fine.
Well, they would say that if they knew how to write English, but they don't say that. They say the cure is worse than the problem. They miss the nice metaphor.
Yeah. But, of course, that only lasts as long as Rand Paul doesn't have the disease.
Right.
Or the problem. This week he... he proved his bona fides by infecting or exposing a whole raft of senators to this thing. And, there's got to be something in the water down in Kentucky, the Ohio River or whatever it is, as it flows down along the borders there of Ohio and Indiana and Illinois and Kentucky. You've got Mitch McConnell. You've got Rand Paul. You've got this Congressman Massey, who made everybody come back for a vote that everybody except him was going to vote for to get this deal passed.
Yeah.
And he took a lot of flack, but even Donald Trump went after him, which, might open up that seat for the Democrats to come the fall. Who knows?
Who knows?
But that's small potatoes on this, but it does demonstrate how ideologically pure they've tried to become on this. And then you had other senators who have been noticeably absent in this debate, like Ben Sasse, who were also mimicking this type of thing. But when push came to shove, he voted for the bailout or the relief bill. It's not really a bailout bill. It's a relief bill. So we had that type of thing, which should be noted.
By the way, I don't think it's right to say that this is a question of, as the Wall Street Journal puts it, economy versus lives. They put it that way because that makes it sound benign. Their definition of economy is profitability, the restoration of the rate of profit versus old people's lives. That's how that's really what it's all about. And what Kuttner, when they, was it Kuttner?
Kushner?
No,
the
president's
Kudlow. Mr. Always Wrong Kudlow.
Yeah, Mr. Always Wrong Kudlow, the president's chief economics advisor, never gets anything right, doesn't understand economics, never studied economics, as far as I can see, said we have to consider, there are trade-offs. There are trade-offs between the lives of old people and the restoration of the rate of profit. He said that. I heard him say it.
Yeah.
There are recordings of him saying it.
You know, that really brings us to an interesting point, because Trump has been the darling of the self-proclaimed pro-life movement. And now all of a sudden, and a lot of these people are older people, older evangelicals, older Catholics, who have backed Donald Trump because he's giving them judges who will fight against abortion under the name of pro-life. And now their lives are being put at stake. They're being told some lives are more important than others. Or
but
your
that
life
guy down in Texas, the deputy attorney general or whatever.
The lieutenant governor, Dan Patrick.
Dan Patrick, the lieutenant governor, said he would willingly sacrifice his life for the restoration of American corporate profits.
Yeah.
Well, he ought to do it. I'd like to. I'm waiting for him to do it. I don't see him rushing forward doing it. But yeah. I wouldn't do it.
No. But he's. But you have that. That. Where it really is a challenge to the pro-life movement. Of course, they won't see it that way because in many respects, there really isn't about life as much as it about anti-abortion and controlling women's bodies. Yeah. And then you get back to the Trump attacks on women again on that. Now, that's not to say that there aren't people who have a genuine belief in this and are consistent in that movement. There are many, but the leadership.
And they have a genuine belief in it, but they're wrong nonetheless.
Yeah. But they're, a lot of the leadership has proven very, very malleable in this type of situation where you have that.
But a genuine belief is no argument, right? I may genuinely believe that all Jews are inferior. That's not my genuine belief doesn't matter.
Well, we have Donald Trump's genuine beliefs versus science.
That's right. Yeah. Maybe he genuinely, who knows what he believes, you know.
But
let's assume he does. Let's assume because he is consistently anti-science that he genuinely believes that science doesn't count, it's not right.
Well, that's another, thing that we have here. We have facts versus beliefs or hopes or whatever on this. And, of course, Donald Trump is throwing stuff out that he hopes will – everything that he's said so far has been wrong, but he hopes something will prove right, and he can say, aha, I told you so. Remember, it was going to go away magically and all of this stuff.
Well, he says, who even knows what this is? We don't even know. Nobody really knows. Nonsense. We know exactly what it is.
There's been this attack on expertise and elitism that has gone on. And now, then you get a guy like Anthony Fauci, who is an elitist, who is an expert, who's been telling people the truth about what's going on here, and who are you going to believe on this thing? You're going to believe him or whatever? And what we found out is if you listen to Fox, you have far less belief in people like him than if you listen to CNBC or CNN on this. And I think you told me before we went on the air that Fauci's job may be in jeopardy.
Well, Politico reported that Trump is very dissatisfied with Fauci and is trying to figure out how to get away from him.
Yeah, but right now he needs him more than he can get away from him.
Well,
but
people believe Fauci because he tells the truth, and everybody knows it.
Now CNN has been running new ads about Facts Matter. They had an ad campaign, which I thought was pretty brilliant couple of years ago about this thing. But they've continued to contribute to the problem because they've continued to run Trump's so-called press conferences or daily briefings without much criticism, although last night I did see a comment on the screen saying that he was wrong in what he was stating on there, but it's too little, and the reporting has been terrible. Reporters aren't following up; they're not there to challenge him. They're giving him a free rein on this. And what was it a week? Was it earlier this week that Sean Spicer was actually able to get into the press conference and ask a softball question?
Yeah.
I mean,
his former press secretary.
He should be dancing in the stars. Guy. I mean, the kind of things that are going on. Well,
they gave the NBC and CNN MSNBC. Gave Trump, I don't know how many billions of dollars worth of free publicity in 2016. And basically, for his campaign, and they're basically doing it now.
Yeah.
Well, listen, that's all we got for today. I don't think that we can go through much more than this because there's so much to go through. But it's not going to go away. We got all of next week. The crisis is going to get worse.
And we're under a stay-in at home type of order now.
Yeah. Yeah. So you got plenty of time to study.
Yeah, we have plenty of time, and we have to stay safe. And we'll stay safe.
Don't mingle. Don't go out. If you have to go shopping, try to stay 6 feet away from anybody and wash your hands.
It's yes, And it's difficult in the shopping situations, but you have to do it.
You have to do it. See you next week.
See you next week.
You've been listening to Forward with Falk. Longtime Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen discuss politics. Join them again next week, same time, same place. This program is supported by Argosy Bookshop of New York City, 116 East 59th Street, just down the block from Bloomingdale's. Old and rare books, prints and maps, members of the International League of Antiquarian Booksellers, founding members of the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, members of the Appraisers Association of America, on the web at Argosy Books, ArgosyBooks.com. Check them out for books, autographs, maps, and prints.